steady enough, steadier than Sloat's.
Mark Hartley, I see.
The SS man smiled a peculiar, chilling smile, his eyes wide and serious. It was the smile of the Polish soldier on the road to Warsaw, who had yanked the beard of the taxi driver.
Hartley, he repeated.
And under what name were you born?
That name.
Really? What were your parents?
Both Americans.
Jews?
Byron said, I happen to know him, sir. We've been going to church together all the time in Warsaw. He's a Methodist, like me. The tall, silver-haired minister, standing near Clara Young, ran his fingers inside his clerical collar. I can vouch for that. I conducted services when Mr. Hartley was present. Mark is a devout Christian. The SS officer, with a disagreeable, puzzled grin, said to Sloat,
This one is certainly Jewish. I think a little physical examination would...
Sloat broke in. I would report that as personal violence. In America, circumcision at birth is routine. I'm circumcised, said Byron.
So am I, said the old clergyman.
In the rest of the waiting room, the process of sorting out the Jews was over. People were glancing at the Americans, pointing and whispering. The SS men were gathered at the entrance, all except a stout, bald one with gold leaf in his black lapels, who now approached the American party, pulled aside the officer, and murmured with him, glancing at Hartley. The officer, without a word, pushed through to Hartley, took his suitcase, and undid the straps. Sloat said sharply,
Hold on, sir, this is not a customs point, and there's no reason to search personal belongings.
But the officer, down on one knee, already had the bag open and was rummaging in it, spilling its contents on the floor. He came on the New Testament, turned it over in his hands, with an expression half astounded, half sneering, and brought it to his superior officer. The bald man examined it, handed it back, and threw his hands in the air.
So, he said in German, in 100 Americans, maybe not one. Why not? Any Jew would have been an idiot to come to Warsaw this summer. Come, the train is being delayed.
He walked off. The SS man tossed the black book with the gold cross in the open bag and rudely gestured at Hartley to pick up his belongings, stepping over the pile as though it were garbage. Scanning the other faces in the group, he stepped up to Natalie Jastrow and gave her a long, amused scrutiny. "Well, what are you looking at?" she said, and Byron's heart sank.
"You're very pretty."
"Thank you."
"Rather dark. Your ancestry?"
"I'm Italian."
"What is your name?"
"Mona Lisa."
"I see. You step forward."
Natalie did not move. The officer grunted and began turning the pages of the roster. Sloat quickly said, "She's my fiancée. We'll be married next month." The bald officer shouted from the entrance and waved at the SS man, who roughly handed the roster to Sloat.
"Very well. You love your Jews. Why do you refuse to take in ours? We have swarms."
He turned to Byron.
"You're the son of a naval officer, and yet you lie about a Jew. That fellow is a Jew."
"He's not, honestly," Byron said. "I think Mark sort of looks like Dr. Goebbels. You know, short, dark, with a big nose."
"Dr. Goebbels. So."
The SS man glared at Hartley and Natalie, broke into a nasty laugh, and walked off. A loudspeaker called out in German,
"All Jews to the restaurant! Everybody else to track 7 and board the train!"
The refugees went crowding out to the dark tracks. The Jews, a forlorn little group, straggled back to the dining room, with men in black surrounding them. Soldiers halted the crowd at the train to allow diplomats aboard first. Sloat muttered to Byron, I'll take a compartment. You'll see me at the window. Bring Natalie and Mark, and by all means, Reverend Glenville and his wife. Soon, through billowing steam, Byron could see the chargé waving from inside the dimly lit train. Byron came aboard with the four others in a suffocating crush and found the compartment.
Thanks,
Hartley whispered when they were all seated and Sloat had slid shut the door.
A million thanks. Thanks to all of you. God bless you.
Leslie Sloat is the man, said the minister. You did nobly, Leslie.
Nobly, said Natalie.
Sloat looked at her with a hangdog smile, as though not sure she was serious.
Well, I was on pretty good ground. They tried to get that information from me at Kantorovich, you know, and couldn't. They got it from all the others. That's why the separation went so fast here.
But why the devil did you make that Mona Lisa joke?
It was very risky, the minister said.
Idiotic, Hartley said. They were talking in whispers, though the corridor was buzzing with loud talk, the stationary train was hissing and clanging, and a public address system outside was bellowing in German.
How about Byron and Dr. Goebbels? Natalie said with a grin. That was pretty neat, I thought.
Neither of you seems to understand, Hartley said, that these are murderers. Murderers! You're like kids, both of you.
Reverend Glenville said, I'm not willing to believe that, Mr. Hartley. I know the German people. They have had a cruel, unjust system imposed on them, and one day they'll throw it off. At bottom, they are good.
Well, Stockholm ahoy, Natalie said. I admit one thing. I've lost all curiosity about Berlin.
You've got to get your passport back first, Hartley said.
His jolly face was carved in 100 lines and creases of tragic bitterness. He looked extraordinarily old, inhumanely old, the wandering Jew in an American sports jacket.
The train started with a wrenching clang. Byron now pulled out the yellow envelope. The message, on a Wehrmacht official form, had these few English words.
Glad you're okay. Come straight to Berlin. Dad.
Chapter 15. The long string of cars squealed into the Friedrichstrasse terminal in clouds of white vapor, clanking, slowing. Rhoda clutched Victor Henry's arm and jumped up and down, to the amusement of the uniformed foreign ministry man who had escorted them to meet the train from Königsberg.
Pug observed his smile.
"We haven't seen our boy in over a year," he shouted above the train noise.
"Ah, well, then this is a great moment."
The train stopped and people came swarming out.
"My God!" exclaimed Rhoda. "Is that him coming down those steps? Oh, it can't be him. He's a skeleton."
"Where? Where?" Pug said.
"He disappeared somewhere over there. No, there he is."
Byron's chestnut hair was very long and curly, almost matted. The bones stood out in his pale face, and his eyes looked bright and enormous. He was laughing and waving, but at first blink, his father almost failed to recognize this long-jawed, sharp-chinned young man with the shabby clothes and raffish hair.
"It's me! This is me!" he heard Byron yell. "Don't you even know me, Dad?"
Pug plunged toward Byron, holding Rhoda's hand. Byron, smelling of wine, embraced him in a tight, fierce, long hug, scratching his father's face with a two-day growth of bristles. Then he hugged and kissed his mother.
"Gad, I'm reeling," he said, in a swooping note like Rhoda's, but in a rough baritone voice.
"They've been feeding us on this train like hogs going to market. I just finished a lunch with three different wines.
Mom, you look beautiful. About 25.
"Well, you look ghastly. Why the devil were you running around in Poland?" The foreign ministry man pulled at Byron's elbow.
You do feel you have been treated well, Mr. Henry? Dr. Neustadter, Foreign Ministry, he said, with a click of heels and a crinkly smile.
Oh, hi. Oh, irreproachably, sir, irreproachably, Byron said, laughing wildly. That is, once we got out of Warsaw. In there, it was kind of rough.
Ah, well, that's war. We'd be pleased to have a little note from you about your treatment, at your convenience. My card.
Leslie Sloat, ashen and distraught, came up with two hands full of documents and introduced himself to Victor Henry.
I'd like to call on you at the embassy tomorrow, sir, he said, once I've straightened things out a bit.
Come in any time, Pug Henry said.
But let me tell you right now, Sloat said over his shoulder as he left, that Byron's been a real help.
Dr. Neustadter politely emphasized that Byron could go off in his father's custody now and pick up his documents some other time. Or he himself could look after Byron's papers and drop them at Commander Henry's office.
After all, Neustadter said, when it's a question of a son rejoining his parents, red tape becomes inhumane.
Rhoda sat beside her son as they drove to Grunewald, happily clutching his arm while complaining how awful he looked. He was her secret favorite. Rhoda had thought of the name Byron at her first glimpse of her baby in the hospital, a scrawny infant, blinking big blue eyes in a red triangular face. Clearly a boy, even in the rolls of baby flesh. She thought the child had a manly, romantic look. She had hoped he would be an author or an actor. She had even unclenched his tiny red fists to look for the writer's triangles, which, she had read somewhere, one could see at birth in a baby's palm wrinkles. Byron hadn't turned out a writer, but he did actually have, she thought, a romantic streak. Secretly, she sympathized with his refusal to consider a naval career, and even with his lazy school habits. She had never liked Pug's nickname for the boy, Briny, with its smell of the sea, and it was years before she would use it. Byron's switch to fine arts at Columbia, which had thrown Pug into black despondency, she had silently welcomed. Warren was a Henry, the plugger, the driver, the one who got things done, the A student, the one with his eye on flag rank and every step up toward it. Byron was like her, she thought, a person of fine quality, haunted and somewhat disabled by an unfulfilled dream. She noticed the scar on his temple, touched it in alarm, and asked about it. He began narrating his odyssey from Krakow to Warsaw, interrupting himself now and then to exclaim at things he saw in the streets. Red vertical swastika banners massed around a statue of Frederick the Great. A band of Hitler youth marching past in their brown shirts, black neckerchiefs, and short black pants. Nuns bicycling down the Friedrichstrasse. A band concert in a park. A turning merry-go-round.
It's so peaceful, isn't it? So goddamned peaceful. Dad, what's happening in the war? Has Warsaw surrendered? Have the Allies gotten off their tails yet? The Germans are such liars, you never know.
Warsaw is still holding out, but the war there is really over. There's a lot of talk about peace in the West, too.
Honestly, already? God, will you look at that cafe? 500 Berliners, if there's one, eating pastry and drinking coffee, laughing, talking. Ah, to be a Berliner. Where was I? Oh, yes. Well, anyway, at this point, see, the water pump gave out, and the fan belt broke. The German planes never stopped going by overhead. The bride was having hysterics. We were 20 miles from the nearest town. There was a cluster of farmhouses about a mile down the road, but they'd been bombed to pieces, so...
Farmhouses? Pug broke in alertly.
But the Germans keep claiming loud and clear that the Luftwaffe is attacking only military targets. That's a big boast of theirs.
Byron roared with laughter.
What? Dad, the military targets of the Germans include anything that moves, from a pig on up. I was a military target. There I was, above the ground and alive. I saw 1,000 houses blown apart out in the countryside, far behind the front. The Luftwaffe is just practicing on them, getting ready for France and England. You want to be careful how you talk here, Rhoda said. We're in the car. That's safe, isn't it?
Sure it is. Go on, Pug said.
He was thinking that Byron's story might turn into an intelligence report. The Germans were indignantly complaining about Polish atrocities and publishing revolting photographs of mutilated ethnic Germans and Wehrmacht officers. By contrast, they offered photographic proof of happy, captured Polish soldiers eating, drinking, and doing folk dances. Pictures of Jews being fed at soup kitchens, waving at the cameras and smiling. And many photographs of German guns and trucks rolling past farmhouses and through untouched towns, with jovial Polish peasants cheering them. Byron's tale cast an interesting light on all this. On and on Byron talked. At the Grunewald house, they went into the garden. "Hey, a tennis court! Great!" he exclaimed in the same manic tone. They sat in reclining chairs, drinks in their hands, as he described the siege of Warsaw with extraordinary clarity, picking out details that made them see and hear and even smell the whole thing. The dead horses on the streets, the tank traps and the menacing sentries at the corners, the unflushed toilets at the embassy when the water main broke. The gangs trying to put out roaring fires in a whole block of buildings with buckets of sand. The taste of horse meat, the sound of artillery, the wounded piled in the hospital lobby, the facade of a synagogue slowly sliding down into the street, the embassy cellar with its rows of canvas cots, the eerie walk across no man's land on a quiet dirt road dotted with autumn wildflowers. The blue-gray Berlin evening drew on, and still Byron talked, getting hoarse, drinking steadily, and losing no coherence or clarity. It was an astonishing performance. Again and again the parents looked at each other. "I get famished just talking about it," Byron said. He was describing the startling feast laid out by the Germans in the Klovno railroad station. "And there was another spread just like it when we got to Königsberg. They've been stuffing us ever since on the train. I don't know where it all goes to. I think in Warsaw I must have digested the marrow out of my bones. They got hollow, and they're just now filling up again. Anyway, when and where and how do we eat?" "You look like such a tramp, Byron," Rhoda said. "Don't you have any other clothes?" "A whole big bag full, Mom. It's in Warsaw, neatly labeled with my name. Probably it's ashes by now." They went to a small, dark little restaurant off the Kurfürstendamm. Byron laughed, pointing to the fly-specked, curling cardboard sign in the window. "This restaurant does not serve Jews." "Are there any left in Berlin to serve?"
"Well, you don't see them around much," Pug said. "They're not allowed in the theaters and so forth. I guess they're lying pretty low."
"Ah, to be a Berliner," Byron said. "Warsaw's alive with Jews." He stopped talking when the soup came. Apparently his own voice had been keeping him awake, because between the soup and the meat course, his head nodded and dropped on his chest. They had trouble rousing him.
"Let's get him home," Pug said, signaling to the waiter. "I was wondering how long he'd last."
"What? Let's not go home," Byron said. "Let's go to the theater, the opera. Let's have some civilized fun. Let's do the town. Ah, to be a Berliner," Pug said after they had put Byron to sleep and were strolling in the garden.
"Quite a change in him."
"It's that girl," Rhoda said.
He didn't say much about her.
That's my point. He said nothing about her. Yet he went to Poland because of her and got caught in Krakow on account of her. He lost his passport, for heaven's sakes, protecting her relatives. Why, he was talking to her uncle when that synagogue all but fell on top of him. Seems to me he did almost everything in Poland but become a Jew.
Pug looked coldly at her, but she went on unheedingly.
Maybe you can find out something more about her from this man, Sloat. It's a strange business, and she must be some girl.
Topping the pile of letters on Pug's desk the following morning was a pale green envelope, almost square, engraved in one corner, the White House. Inside he found on a single sheet, similarly engraved, a slanted scrawl in heavy pencil.
"You were dead right again, old top. Treasury just now informs me the ambassadors got hopping mad at the very idea of our offering to buy their ocean liners. Can I borrow your crystal ball? Write me a letter whenever you get a chance about your life in Berlin, what you and your wife do for fun, who your German friends are, what the people and the newspapers are saying, how the food is in the restaurants, just anything and everything that occurs to you. What does a loaf of bread cost in Germany today? Washington is still incredibly hot and muggy, though the leaves have started turning. FDR.
Pug put all other mail aside and stared at the curious communication from the curious man whom he had once soaked with salt water, who was now his commander-in-chief, the creator of the New Deal, of which Pug disapproved. The man with perhaps the best-known name and face on Earth, except Hitler's. The cheerful, banal scribble was out of key with Roosevelt's stature, but it very much fitted the cocky young man who had bounced around on the Davy in a blazer and straw hat. He pulled a yellow pad toward him and listed points for an informal letter about his life in Berlin, for obedience and quick action were Navy habits soaked into his bones. The yeoman's buzzer rang. He flipped the key.
"No calls, Whittle."
"Aye, aye, sir. There's a Mr. Sloat asking to see you, but I can—"
"Sloat, no, hold on. I'll see Sloat. Let us have coffee."
The Foreign Service man looked rested and fit, if a bit gaunt, in his freshly pressed tweed jacket and flannel trousers.
"Quite a view," Sloat said.
"Is that huge pink pile the new chancellery?"
"Yes, you can see them change the guard from here."
"I don't know that I'm interested in armed Germans on the move. I have the idea."
Both men laughed. Over the coffee, the commander told Sloat something of Byron's four-hour gush of narrative. The diplomat listened with a wary look, running his fingers repeatedly over the rim of his lit pipe. "Did he mention anything about that unfortunate business in Praha?" Henry looked puzzled. "When we had a girl in the car and found ourselves under German shellfire?"
"I don't believe so. Was the girl Natalie Jastrow?"
"Yes. The incident involved the Swedish ambassador and an auto trip to the front lines." Pug thought a moment. Sloat watched his face intently.
"No, not a word."
With a heavy sigh, Sloat brightened up.
"Well, he exposed himself to direct enemy fire, while I had to take the girl out of the car and find shelter for her."
Sloat baldly narrated his version of the episode. Then he described Byron's water-hauling, his handiness in making repairs, his disregard of enemy planes and artillery shelling.
"I'd be glad to put all this in a letter, if you wish," Sloat said. "Yes, I'd like that," Pug said with alacrity. "Now, tell me something about this Jastrow girl."
"What would you like to know?"
Victor Henry shrugged. "Anything. My wife and I are slightly curious about this young female who got our boy into such a jam. What the hell was she doing in Warsaw, with all of Europe mobilizing? And why was he with her?"
Sloat laughed wryly.
"She came to see me. We're old friends. I thought she was out of her mind to come. I did my best to stop her. This girl is a sort of lioness type. She does what she pleases, and you just get out of the way. Her uncle didn't want her to travel alone, what with all the war talk. Byron volunteered to go along. That's as I understand it.
He went with her to Poland as a courtesy to Dr. Jastrow. Is that the size of it?
Maybe you'd better ask Byron.
Is she beautiful?
Sloat puffed thoughtfully, staring straight ahead.
In a way, quite a brain, very educated.
Abruptly, he looked at his watch and stood up. I'll write you that letter, and I'm going to mention your son in my official report.
Good. I'll ask him about that incident in Praha.
Oh, no, there's no need. It was just an instance of how he cooperated.
You're not engaged to the Jastrow girl.
No, I'm not.
Well, I hate to get personal, but you're much older than Byron, and quite different, and I can't picture a girl who bridges that gap.
Sloat looked at him and said nothing.
Pug went on. Where is she now?
She went to Stockholm with most of our people. Goodbye, Commander Henry.
Rhoda telephoned Pug around noon, breaking into his work on the letter to Roosevelt.
That boy's slept 14 hours, she said. I got worried and went in there, but he's breathing like an infant, with a hand tucked under his cheek.
Well, let him sleep.
Doesn't he have to report somewhere?
No. Sleep's the best thing for him.
Complying with the president's orders to write chattily, Pug closed his letter with a short account of Byron's adventures in Poland. Plans were growing in his mind for official use of his son's experiences. He filed the letter for the diplomatic pouch and went home uneasy at having bypassed the chain of command and wasted a workday. He did also feel vague pride in his direct contact with the president, but that was a human reaction. In his professional judgment, this contact was most likely a bad thing. Byron was reclining in the garden, eating grapes from a bowl and reading a Superman comic book. Scattered on the grass beside him were perhaps 2 dozen more comic books, a patchwork of lurid covers.
"Hi, Dad," he said.
"How about this treasure? Franz collects them."
Franz was the butler.
"He says he's been panhandling or buying them from tourists for years."
Pug was stupefied at the sight. Comic books had been a cause of war in their household until Byron had gone off to Columbia. Pug had forbidden them, torn them up, burned them, fined Byron for possession of them. Nothing had helped. The boy had been like a dope fiend. With difficulty, Pug refrained from saying something harsh. Byron was 24.
"How do you feel?"
"Hungry," Byron said. "God, this is a great Superman. It makes me homesick, reading these things."
Franz brought Pug a highball on a tray. Pug sat silently with it, waiting for the butler to go. It took a while, because Franz wiped a glass-top table, cut some flowers, and fooled with a loose screen door to the tennis court. He had a way of lingering within earshot. Meanwhile, Byron read the Superman through, put it on the pile, and looked idly at his father. Pug relaxed and sipped his drink. Franz was re-entering the house.
"Briny, that was quite a tale you told us yesterday."
The son laughed.
"I guess I got kind of carried away, seeing you and Mom again. Also, Berlin had a funny effect on me." "You've had access to unusual information. I don't know if there's another American who went from Krakow to Warsaw after the war broke out."
"Oh, I guess it's all been in the papers and magazines."
"That's where you're wrong. There's a lot of arguing between the Germans and the Poles, the few Poles who got away and can still argue, about who's committed what atrocities in Poland. An eyewitness account like yours would be an important document."
Byron shrugged, picking up another comic book.
"Possibly.
I want you to write it up. I'd like to forward your account to the Office of Naval Intelligence.
Gosh, Dad, aren't you overestimating it?
No. I'd like you to get at it tonight.
I don't have a typewriter,
Byron said with a yawn. There's one in the library, Pug said.
Oh, that's right, I saw it. Well, okay.
With such casual assents, Byron had often dodged his homework in the past, but his father let it go. He was clinging to a belief that Byron had matured under the German bombing. That fellow Sloat came by today, said you helped out a lot in Warsaw, brought water to the embassy and such. Well, yes, I got stuck with the water job. Also, there was an incident at the front line with the Swedish ambassador. You climbed a tower under German fire while Sloat had to hide this Jastro girl in a farmhouse. It seems to be very much on his mind. Byron opened Horror Comics with a cover picture of a grinning skeleton carrying a screaming half-naked girl up a stone staircase. Oh, yes, that was right before we crossed No Man's Land. I made a sketch of the road.
Why does Sloat dwell on it?
Well, it's about the last thing that happened before we left Warsaw, so I guess it remained in his mind.
He intends to write me a letter of commendation about you.
He does. That's fine. Has he got any word on Natalie?
Just that she's gone to Stockholm. You'll start on that report tonight?
Sure. Byron left the house after dinner and returned at 2 in the morning. Pug was awake, working in the library and worrying about his son, who blithely told him he had gone with other Americans to the opera. Under his arm, Byron carried a new copy of Mein Kampf in English. Next day, when Pug left the house, Byron was up and dressed, lounging on the back porch in slacks and a sweater, drinking coffee and reading Mein Kampf. At 7 in the evening, the father found Byron in the same place, in the same chair, drinking a highball. He was well into the thick tome, which lay open on his lap. Rubbing bleary eyes, he gave his father a listless wave. Pug said,
"Did you start on that report?"
"I'll get to it, Dad. Say, this is an interesting book. Did you read it?"
"I did, but I didn't find it interesting. About 50 pages of those ravings give you the picture. I thought I should finish it, so I did, but it was like wading through mud."
Byron shook his head. "Really amazing," and turned the page.
He went out again at night, returned late, and fell asleep with his clothes on, an old habit that ground on Pug's nerves. Byron woke around 11 and found himself undressed and under the covers, his clothes draped on a chair, with a note propped on them. "Write that goddamn report." He was idling along the Kurfürstendamm that afternoon, with Mein Kampf under his arm, when Leslie Sloat went hurrying past him, halted, and turned.
"Well, there you are. That's luck. I've been trying to get hold of you. Are you coming back to the States with us or not? Our transportation's set for Thursday."
"I'm not sure. How about some coffee and pastry? Let's be a couple of Berliners."
Sloat pursed his lips. "To tell the truth, I skipped lunch. All right. What the devil are you reading that monstrosity for?"
"I think it's great."
"Great? That's an unusual comment."
They sat at a table in an enormous sidewalk cafe, where potted flowering bushes broke up the expanse of tables and chairs, and a brass band played gay waltzes in the sunshine.
"God, this is the life," Byron said, as they gave orders to a bowing, smiling waiter. "Look at all these nice, polite, cordial, joking, happy Berliners, will you? Did you ever see a nicer city? So clean. All those fine statues and Baroque buildings, like that marvelous opera, and all the spanking new modern ones, and all the gardens and trees. Why, I've never seen such a green, clean city." Berlin's almost like a city built in a forest. And all the canals, and the quaint little boats. Did you see that tug that sort of tips its smokestack to get under the bridges? Completely charming. The only thing is, these pleasant folks have just been blowing the hell out of Poland, machine-gunning people from the sky. I've got the scar to prove it. Pounding a city just as nice as Berlin to a horrible pulp. It's a puzzle, you might say. Sloat shook his head and smiled. The contrast between the war front and the back area is always startling. No doubt Paris was as charming as ever while Napoleon was out doing his butcheries. Sloat, you can't tell me the Germans aren't strange. Oh, yes, the Germans are strange. Well, that's why I've been reading this book, to try to figure them out. It's their leader's book. Now, it turns out this is the writing of an absolute nut. The Jews are secretly running the world, he says. That's his whole message. They're the capitalists. But they're the Bolsheviks, too, and they're conspiring to destroy the German people, who, by rights, should really be running the world. Well, he's going to become dictator, see? Wipe out the Jews, crush France, and carve off half of Bolshevist Russia for more German living space. Have I got it right so far? A bit simplified, but yes, pretty much. Sloat sounded amused, but uneasy, glancing at the tables nearby. Okay, now all these nice Berliners like this guy, right? They voted for him. They follow him. They salute him. They cheer him. Don't they? How is that? Isn't that very strange? How come he's their leader? Haven't they read this book? How come they didn't put him in a padded cell? Don't they have insane asylums? And who do they put in there if not this guy? Sloat, while stuffing his pipe, kept looking here and there at the people around them. Satisfied that nobody was eavesdropping, he said in a low tone, "Are you just discovering the phenomenon of Adolf Hitler?" "I just got shot in the head by a German. That sort of called my attention to it." "Well, you won't learn much from Mein Kampf. That's just froth on top of a kettle." "Do you understand Hitler and the Germans?" Sloat lit his pipe and stared at the air for several seconds. Then he spoke, with a wry little smile of academic condescension. "I have an opinion, the result of a lot of study." "Can I hear it? I'm interested." "It's a terribly long story, Byron, and quite involved." Sloat glanced around again. "Some other time and place I'd be glad to, but would you give me the names of books to read, then?" "Are you serious? You'd let yourself in for some dull plotting." "I'll read anything you tell me to." "Well, let me have your book." On the flyleaf of Mein Kampf, Sloat listed authors and titles all the way down the page in a neat, slanted hand in purple Polish ink. Running his eye down the list, Byron felt his heart sink at the unfamiliar array of Teutonic authors, each name followed by a heavy book title, some by two. Treitschke, Müller-Vandenbroek, Fries, Menzel, Fichte, Schlegel, Arndt, Jahn, Rus, Lagarde, Langbein, Spengler. Among them, like black raisins in much gray dough, a few names from his contemporary civilization course at Columbia caught his eye. Luther, Kant, Hegel, Schopenhauer, Nietzsche. He remembered that course as a nuisance and a nightmare. He had passed with a D-minus, after frantic all-night cramming of smudgy lecture notes from the fraternity files. Sloat drew a heavy line and added more books with equally forbidding authors' names. Santayana, Mann, Veblen, Renan, Heine, Kolne, Rauschning. Below the line are critics and analysts, he remarked as he wrote. Above are some German antecedents of Hitler. I think you must grasp these to grasp him. Byron said dolefully, "Really? The philosophers too, Hegel and Schopenhauer? Why? And Martin Luther, for pity's sake. Contemplating the list with a certain arid satisfaction, Sloat added a name or two as he pulled hard at his pipe, making the bowl hiss. My view is that Hitler and the Nazis have grown out of the heart of German culture. A cancer, maybe, but a uniquely German phenomenon. Some very clever men have given me hell for holding this opinion. They insist the same thing could have happened anywhere, given the same conditions. Defeat in a major war, a harsh peace treaty, ruinous inflation, mass unemployment, communism on the march, anarchy in the streets, all leading to the rise of a demagogue and a reign of terror. But I... The waiter was approaching. Sloat shut up and said not a word while they were being served. Watching the waiter until he went out of sight, the Foreign Service man drank coffee and ate cake. Then he started again, almost in an undertone. But I don't believe it. To me, Nazism is unthinkable without its roots in German 19th-century thought. Romanticism, idealism, nationalism, the whole outpouring. It's in those books. If you're not prepared to read every word of Hegel's Philosophy of History, for instance, give up. It's basic. He shoved the book back to Byron, open at the flyleaf. Well, there you are, for a starter. Tacitus, Byron said. Why Tacitus? Isn't he a Roman historian? Yes. Do you know about Arminius and the Battle of the Teutoburger Forest? No, I don't. Okay. In the year 9 A.D., Byron, a German war leader named Arminius stopped the Romans at the Rhine once and for all, and so secured the barbarian sanctuary in the heart of Europe. It's a key event in world history. It led eventually to the fall of Rome. It's affected all European politics and war to this hour. So I believe, and therefore I think you should read Tacitus's account of the campaign. Either you go into these things, or you don't. Byron kept nodding and nodding, his eyes narrowed and attentive. You've read all these books, every one. Sloat regarded the younger man quizzically, gnawing his pipe. I haven't retained them as well as I should, but yes, I have. What you're actually trying to tell me, I imagine, is to go peddle my papers, that this is a subject for Rhodes scholars. Not at all, but it is a hard subject. Now, Byron, I'm really overdue at the embassy. Are you or aren't you coming with us? We fly to Oslo Thursday, and from there to London. Then we just take our chances. Destroyer, freighter, ocean liner, maybe an airplane trip via Lisbon, whatever turns up. Byron said, What are Natalie's plans? She got kind of snappish with me toward the end and wouldn't talk much. Sloat looked at his watch. She was disagreeable and vague with me, too. I really don't know. He hesitated. I'll tell you something else. You may not like it. You may not believe it. But it's so, and possibly you'd be better off knowing it. Go ahead. I asked her about you, whether you planned to return to Siena. Her answer was, Well, I hope not. I sincerely hope I never see Byron Henry again, and if you ever get a chance, please tell him so with my compliments. You look surprised. Didn't you have an argument before she left? I was positive you had. Byron, trying to compose his face, said, Not exactly. She just seemed grouchy as hell. Sloat said, She was in a gruesome mood. Said she had a bad backache from all the train riding, for one thing. Very likely she meant nothing by it. I know she felt grateful to you, as indeed I do. Byron shook his head. I can't say I've ever understood her. Sloat glanced at the check and said, tucking bright-colored marks under a saucer, Well, look, Byron, there's no time to discuss Natalie Jastrow. I'll tell you this. I've had no peace of mind since the day I first met her 2 years ago at a very stupid cocktail party on the Quai Voltaire. "Why don't you marry her?" Byron said, as Sloat started to rise. The older man fell back in his chair and looked at him for several seconds. "All right, I'm not at all sure I won't, Byron, if she'll have me." "Oh, she'll have you. I'll tell you what. I guess I'll stay on here with my folks for a while. I won't go to Oslo." Sloat stood, holding out his hand. "I'll give your passport and so forth to your father's yeoman. Good luck." Byron said, shaking hands and gesturing at Mein Kampf. "I appreciate the lecture and the list." "Small return," Sloat said, "for services rendered." "Will you let me know," Byron said, "if you get word before you leave Berlin about where Natalie went?" Knocking out his pipe against his palm, Sloat said, "Certainly," and hurried off into the sidewalk crowd. Byron ordered more ersatz coffee and opened Mein Kampf, as the cafe band struck up a merry Austrian folk dance. Chapter 16. During Victor Henry's absence in the States, his wife had tangled herself in a romance, something she had not done in his much longer absences through almost 25 years. There was something liberating for her in the start of a war. She was 45. Suddenly, the rules she had lived by so long seemed slightly out of date. The whole world was shaking itself loose from the past. Why shouldn't she, just a wee bit? Rhoda Henry did not articulate this argument. She felt it in her bones and acted on it. Being an ex-beauty and remaining pretty, she had always drawn and enjoyed the attention of men, so she had not lacked opportunities for affairs. But she had been as faithful to Pug Henry as he had been to her. She liked to go to church. Her hymn singing and prayers were heartfelt. She believed in God. She thought Jesus Christ was her Savior, if she had never gone deeply into the matter. And she was convinced in her soul that a married woman ought to be true and good. In the old Navy wife pastime of ripping apart ladies who had not been true and good, she wielded well-honed claws. Setting aside a trivial kiss here and there, only one episode in the dim past somewhat marred Rhoda's otherwise perfect record. After an officers' club dance in Manila, where she had soaked up too much champagne, Pug, being out at sea in a fleet exercise, Kip Tolliver had brought her home and had managed to get her dress off. Madeline, then a child troubled by bad dreams, had saved the situation by waking and starting to cry. By the time Madeline was comforted, Rhoda had sobered up. Relieved to be back from the brink, yet bearing Kip no malice, she had donned a proper housecoat and had amiably shooed him out of the house. That had been the end of it. No doubt Kip, the next morning, had been just as grateful to Madeline. Victor Henry was practically the last man in the Navy he wanted to risk angering. Thereafter, Rhoda was always somewhat kittenish toward Tolliver. Now and then she wondered what would have happened had Madeline not awakened. Would she really have gone through with it? How would she have felt? But she would never know. She did not intend to get that close to trouble again. The wine had been to blame. Still, there had been something titillating about being undressed by a man other than old Pug. Rhoda preserved the memory, though she buried it deep. Dr. Palmer Kirby was a shy, serious, ugly man in his middle 50s. After a dinner party for him, discussing the guests with Sally Forrest, Rhoda had dismissed him as one of these ghastly brains. Just to be sociable, she had vainly tried her usual coquettish babble on Kirby over the cocktails. "Well, since friend husband's away, Dr. Kirby, I've put you on my right, and we can make hay while the sun shines."
On your right, thank you."
That had almost been the end of it. Rhoda detested such heavy men. but he had happened to say at dinner that he was going next day to a factory in Brandenburg. Rhoda offered to drive him there, simply because she had long wanted to see the medieval town, and Kirby, in a sense, was her husband's guest. On the way, they had a dull, decorous lunch at an inn. Over a bottle of Moselle, Kirby warmed up and started to talk about himself and his work. At an alert question she asked him, living with Pug, Rhoda had learned to follow technical talk, Palmer Kirby suddenly smiled. It seemed to her that she had not seen him smile before. His teeth were big, and the smile showed his gums. It was a coarse, male smile of knowledge and appetite, far from disagreeable, but startling in the saturnine engineer. "Do you really care, Mrs. Henry?" said Dr. Kirby. "I'd be glad to explain the whole business, but I have a horror of boring a beautiful woman." The smile, the words, the tone, all disclosed that the man had missed none of her coquetry, that, on the contrary, he liked her. A bit flustered, she touched a hand to her hair, tucking the waves behind her small white ears. "I assure you it all sounds fascinating. Just use words of one syllable as much as possible." "Okay, but you brought this on yourself." He told her all about magnetic amplifiers. Mag amps, he called them, devices for precise control of voltages and currents, especially in high power. Asking one adroit question after another, Rhoda soon drew out the key facts about him. At the California Institute of Technology, he had written his doctoral thesis on electromagnetism. At 40, he had decided to manufacture magnetic amplifiers on his own, instead of settling for an executive post at General Electric or Westinghouse, and security for life. The long struggle for financing had all but sunk him. It was just now paying off. War industries demanded mag amps in quantity, and he was first in the field. He had come to Germany because the Germans were ahead of the United States in the quality of some components. He was studying their techniques and buying their nickel alloy cores. She also learned that he was a widower and a grandfather. He talked about his dead wife, and then they exchanged long confidences about their children's faults and virtues. Like most men, Kirby loved to talk about himself, once over his shyness. His story of back-breaking money troubles and final big success so enthralled her that she forgot to be coy and spoke pleasantly and to the point. Rhoda was most attractive, in fact, when she made the least effort to be. She was the kind of woman who can dazzle a man at first acquaintance by piling everything into the shop window. None of it forced or faked, but in sum, nearly all she has to offer. Victor Henry had long since found that out. He had no complaints, though he had once imagined there must be much more. Palmer Kirby was hit hard by this maximum first impact. He ordered a second bottle of Moselle, and they got into Brandenburg almost an hour late. While he went about his business, Rhoda strolled through the picturesque old town, guidebook in hand. And her mind unaccountably kept wandering to her little misconduct long ago with Kip Tolliver. She was a bit dizzy from the Moselle, and it wore off slowly. When they returned to Berlin toward evening, Kirby offered to take her to dinner and to the opera. It seemed quite natural to accept. Rhoda rushed home and began raking through her dresses and shoes, pushing her hair this way and that, wishing she could have gone to the hairdresser, hesitating over her perfumes. She was still at it when Kirby came to call for her. She kept him waiting for an hour. In girlhood, she had always kept boys waiting. Pug had harshly cured her of the habit, for Navy social life began and ended by the clock, and he would not tolerate embarrassment by Rhoda. Keeping Palmer Kirby waiting while she fussed over herself was a delicious little nostalgic folly, a lovely, childish self-indulgence, like eating a banana split. It almost made Rhoda feel 19 again. The mirror told her a different story, but even it seemed friendly to her that night. It showed shiny eyes, a pretty face, a firm figure in the sheer slip, and arms that were round and thin all the way up, instead of bagging above the elbow as so many women's did. She sailed into the living room wearing the pink suit with gold buttons that she had bought to please Hitler. Kirby sat reading one of Pug's technical journals. He took off big black-rimmed glasses and rose, exclaiming, "Well, don't you look grand!" "I'm awful," she said, taking Kirby's arm. "Dawdling so long. But you brought it on yourself, asking the old girl out after a hard day." The opera was La Traviata, and they enjoyed discovering that they both had always loved it. Afterward, he proposed a glimpse of the notorious Berlin nightlife. It was nothing he'd ever do by himself, he said. Still, Berlin nightlife was the talk of the world, and if it wouldn't offend Mrs. Henry, she might enjoy a peek at it. Rhoda giggled at the notion. "Well, this seems to be my night to howl, doesn't it? Thank you very much for a disreputable suggestion, which I hasten to accept. Let's hope we don't run into any of my friends." So it happened that when the telephone rang in the Henrys' home at 2 in the morning, the long-distance call from New York via the USS Marblehead in Lisbon, there was nobody to answer. Rhoda was sipping champagne, watching a hefty blonde German girl fling her naked breasts about in blue smoky gloom, and glancing every now and then at Dr. Palmer Kirby's long, solemn face in thick-rimmed glasses, as he smoked a long pipe and observed the hard-working, sweaty dancer with faint distaste. Rhoda was aroused and deliciously shocked. She had never before seen a nude dancing woman, except in paintings. After that, until her husband returned, she spent a lot of time with Kirby. They went to the less frequented restaurants. In her own vocabulary, she never did anything. When Pug returned, the adventure stopped. A farewell lunch at Vanze for Palmer Kirby was Rhoda's idea, but she got Sally Forrest to give the lunch, saying she had already sufficiently entertained this civilian visitor. If Sally Forrest detected an oddity in this, she said nothing. With the end of the Polish War at hand, only Warsaw was still holding out, the two attachés felt able to take off some midday hours. Berlin wore a peacetime air, and there was even talk that rationing would soon be over. Byron drove them all out to the resort in an embassy car. Along the broad sandy beach on the Havel River, people strolled in the sun or sat under broad, gaily colored umbrellas, and a number of gymnasts braved the fall breezes to exercise in skimpy costumes. In the luncheon the Forrests ordered, rationing was not much in evidence. The pasty margarine tasted, as usual, like axle grease, but they ate excellent turbot and good leg of lamb. Midway during the lunch, a loudspeaker crackled and whined, and a voice spoke in firm, clear German.
"Attention! In the next few minutes you will hear a report of the highest importance to the fatherland."
The identical words boomed all over the river resort. People stopped on the promenade to listen. On the beach, the small figures of the gymnasts halted briefly in their tumbling or running. An excited murmur rose all through the elegant Kaiser Pavilion restaurant. "What do you suppose?" Sally Forrest said, as the music resumed, thin, gentle Schubert on strings.
"Warsaw, I guess," said her husband. "It must be over."
Dr. Kirby said, "You don't suppose there's an armistice coming up?
I've been hearing Armistice talk all week.
Oh, wouldn't that be marvelous, Rhoda said, and put an end to this stupid war before it really gets going.
Byron said, it's been going.
Oh, of course, said Rhoda with an apologetic smile. They'd have to make some decent settlement of that hideous Polish business.
There'll be no armistice, said Pug.
The buzz of talk rose higher on the crowded terrace and in the dining room. The Germans, eyes bright and gestures animated, argued with each other, laughed, struck the table, and called from all sides for champagne. When the loudspeaker played the few bars of Liszt's music that preceded big news, the noise began to die.
Sondermeldung, special bulletin.
At this announcement, an immediate total stillness blanketed the restaurant, except for a clink here and there. The loudspeaker randomly crackled, then a baritone voice spoke solemn, brief words.
From Supreme Headquarters of the Führer, Warsaw has fallen.
The whole restaurant rang with applause and cheers. Women jumped to their feet and danced. Men shook hands and hugged and kissed each other. Brass band music, first Deutschland über alles, then the Horst Wessel lead, came pouring out of the loudspeakers. To a man, the diners in the Kaiser Pavilion rose, all except the American party. On the beach, on the promenade, wherever the eye turned, the Germans stood still, most of them with arms thrust forward in the Nazi salute. In the dining room, about half were saluting and singing, a discordant swell of voices in the vulgar, beery National Socialist anthem. Victor Henry's skin prickled as he looked around, and he felt at this moment that the Germans under Adolf Hitler would take some beating. He then noticed something he had not seen for many, many years. His son sat still, face frozen, lips pressed in a line, white-knuckled hands clasped on the table. Byron had almost always taken pain and punishment, dry-eyed since the age of 5. But now he was crying. The American party, sitting in a restaurant full of people on their feet, was getting hostile glares.
"Do they expect us to stand?" Sally Forrest said.
"I'm not standing," Rhoda said.
Their waiter, a roly-poly man in black with very long straight blonde hair, hitherto all genial expert service, stood bellowing with arm outstretched, visibly sneering at the Americans. Byron saw none of this. Byron was seeing dead, swollen horses in the gutter, yellow plywood patches on rows of broken buildings, a stone goose bordered with red flowers in a schoolyard, a little girl in a lilac dress taking a pen from him, orange star shells bursting in the night over church domes. The song ended. The Germans applauded and cheered some more and began toasting each other. The string orchestra switched to drinking songs, and the whole Kaiser Pavilion went into a gay roar of Du, du liegst mir im Herzen, du, du liegst mir im Sinn. Byron cringed to hear it, and to recall that a full belly and a glass of beer had brought him to join German soldiers in this song, not 6 hours after he had escaped from burning Warsaw.
Ja, 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 weiß nicht wie gut ich dir bin.
At the American's table, the waiter started removing plates with a jerky clatter, spilling gravy and wine, and jostling them with his elbows.
Watch what you're doing, please,
Colonel Forrest said. The waiter went on with his brusque, sloppy clearing. Sally Forrest gave a little yelp as he struck her head with a plate. Pug said to him,
Look, call your head waiter, please.
Head waiter, I am the head waiter. I am your head.
The man laughed and walked off. Dirty dishes remained scattered on the table.
Wet, purple, and brown messes stained the cloth. Forrest said to Henry,
"It might be smart to leave."
"Oh, by all means," Sally Forrest said. "Just pay Bill and we'll go." She picked up her purse.
"We haven't had our dessert," Pug Henry said.
"It might be an idea to knock that waiter on his behind," Dr. Kirby said, his face disagreeably contorted. "I volunteer," said Byron, and he started to get up.
"For God's sake, boy,"
Colonel Forrest pulled him back.
"An incident is just what he wants, and what we can't have."
The waiter was striding past them to another table. Henry called,
"I asked you to bring your head waiter."
"You're in a hurry, honorable sir," the waiter jeered. "Then you better leave. We're very busy in this restaurant."
He turned a stout back on Henry and walked away.
"Stop. Turn around."
Pug did not shout or bark. He used a dry, sharp tone of command that cut through the restaurant gabble. The waiter stopped and turned.
"Go call your head waiter. Do it immediately."
He looked straight into the waiter's eyes, his face serious and hard. The waiter's glance shifted, and he walked off in another direction. The nearby diners were staring and muttering.
"I think we should go," Sally Forrest said. "This isn't worth the trouble."
The waiter soon approached, followed by a tall, bald, long-faced man in a frock coat, who said with a busy, unfriendly air,
"Yes, you have a complaint."
"We're a party of Americans, military attachés," Pug said. "We didn't rise for your anthem. We're neutrals. This waiter chose to take offense."
He gestured at the table. "He's been deliberately clumsy and dirty. He talked rudely. He's jostled the ladies. His conduct has been swinish. Tell him to behave himself and be good enough to let us have a clean cloth for our dessert."
The expression of the head waiter kept changing as Victor Henry rapped the sentences out. He hesitated under Henry's direct gaze, looked around at the other diners, and all at once burst out in a howl of abuse at the waiter, flinging both arms in the air, his face purpling. After a short, fierce tantrum, he turned to Pug Henry, bowed from the waist, and said coldly,
"You will be properly served. My apologies."
And he bustled off.
Now a peculiar thing happened. The waiter reverted to his former manner without turning a hair, without a trace of surliness, resentment, or regret. The episode was obliterated. It had never happened. He cleared the dishes and spread a new cloth with deft speed. He smiled, he bowed, he made little jokes and considerate little noises. His face was blood red. Otherwise, he was in every respect the same charming, gemütlich German waiter who had first greeted them. He took their dessert orders with chuckles and nods, with arch jests about calories, with solicitous suggestions of wine and liqueurs. He backed away, smiling and bowing, and hastened out of sight.
"I'll be damned," said Colonel Forrest.
"We hadn't had our dessert," Pug said.
"Well done," Kirby said to Pug Henry, with an odd glance at Rhoda.
"Beautifully done."
"Oh, Pug has a way about him," Rhoda said, smiling brightly.
"Okay, Dad," Byron said. Victor Henry shot him a quick look. It was the one remark that gratified him.
The Americans rushed uneasily through their desserts, all but Victor Henry, who was very deliberate about eating his tart and drinking his coffee. He unwrapped a cigar. The waiter jumped to light it for him.
"Well, I guess we can shove off," he said, puffing out a cloud of smoke. "Time's wasting, and the Colonel and I are cheating the U.S. government."
That night, after a late dinner, as they were having coffee on the terrace, Rhoda said, "I see you've brought home a pile of work. I thought we might see that new Emil Jannings movie, but I can get one of the girls to come along."
"Go ahead, I'm no fan of Emil Jannings."
Rhoda drank up her coffee and left the father and son sitting in the gloom.
"Briny, what about that report? How's it coming?"
"The report? Oh, yes, the report." Byron leaned forward in his chair, legs apart, elbows on knees, hands clasped. "Dad, I'd like to ask you something. What would you think of my joining the British Navy, or the RAF?
Victor Henry blinked and took a while to answer. "You want to fight the Germans, I take it."
"I enjoyed myself in Warsaw. I felt useful."
"Well, this is one hell of a change coming from you. I thought a military career was O.U.T. out."
"This isn't a career." Pug sat smoking and looking at his hands, crouching forward in his chair. Byron usually slouched back and extended his long legs, but now he was imitating his father. Their attitudes looked comically alike.
"Briny, I don't think the Allies are going to make a deal with Hitler, but what if they do? A peace offensive's coming up, that's for sure. Suppose you join the British, possibly lose your citizenship, certainly create a peck of problems, and then the war's off. There you'll be, up to your neck in futile red tape. Why not hang on a while and see how the cat jumps?"
"I guess so." Byron sighed and slouched back in his chair. Pug said,
"I don't like to discourage an admirable impulse. What might be a good idea right now is to ask for active duty in our Navy, and..."
"No, thanks. Now hear me out, damn it. You've got your commission. The reserves who go out to sea now will draw the best duty if and when the action starts. You'll have the jump on 99% of the others. In wartime, you'll be the equal of any academy man. Meantime, I'd be in for years, and then suppose the war ends. You're not doing anything else?"
"I wrote to Dr. Jastrow in Siena. I'm waiting to hear from him."
The father dropped the subject.
Rhoda went to see the Emil Jannings movie, but first she did something else. She picked up Dr. Palmer Kirby at his hotel and drove him to Tempelhof Airport. This was not necessary. Cabs were available in Berlin, but she had offered to do this, and Kirby had accepted. Perhaps there would have been no harm in telling her husband that she was giving the visitor this last courtesy, but she didn't. They hardly spoke in the car. She parked and went to the cafe lounge while he checked in. Had she encountered a friend, she would have needed an explanation on the spot and a story for her husband, but she had no such worry. She felt only a bittersweet excitement. What she was doing gave her not the slightest guilty feeling. She had no wrong intent. She liked Palmer Kirby. It was a long, long time since a man had seemed so attractive to her. He liked her, too. In fact, this was a genuine little wartime romance, so decorous as to be almost laughable. An unexpected flash of melancholy magic, which would soon be over forever. It was not in the least like her aborted, drunken peccadillo with Kip Tolliver. "Well, I guess this is it,"
Kirby said, falling in the chair opposite her in the gangling way which always struck her as boyish, for all his grizzled head and sharply lined face. They sat looking at each other until the drinks came.
"Your happiness," he said.
"Oh, that. I've had that. It's all in the past." She sipped. "Did they give you the connection to Lisbon that you wanted?"
"Yes, but the Pan Am Clippers are jammed. I may be hung up in Lisbon for days."
"Well, I wish I had that in prospect. I hear that's becoming the gayest city in Europe."
"Come along."
Oh, Palmer, don't tease me. Dear me, I was supposed to call you Fred, wasn't I? And now I find I've been thinking of you all along as Palmer. Fred. Well, there are so many Freds. You don't strike me as Fred.
That's very strange. He drank at his highball.
What is?
Anne called me Palmer. She never would call me anything else.
Rhoda twirled the stem of her daiquiri glass. I wish I had known your wife.
You'd have become good friends.
Palmer, what do you think of Pug?
That's a tough one.
The engineer pushed his lips out ruefully.
My first impression was that he was a misplaced and, frankly, rather narrow-minded sea dog. But I don't know. He has a keen intellect. He's terrifically on the ball. That was quite a job he did on that waiter. He's a hard man to know, really.
Rhoda laughed.
How right you are. Oh, after all these years, I don't know him too well myself. But I suspect Pug's really something simple and almost obsolete, Palmer. He's a patriot. He's not the easiest person to live with. He's so gall-darned single-minded.
Is he a patriot, or is he a Navy career man? Those are two different things.
Rhoda tilted her head and smiled. I'm not actually sure.
Well, I've come to admire him, that much I know.
Kirby frowned at his big hands, clasped around the drink on the table.
See here, Rhoda, I'm really a proper fellow, all in all. Let me just say this. You're a wonderful woman. I've been a sad, dull man since Anne died, but you've made me feel very much alive again, and I'm grateful to you. Does this offend you?
Don't be a fool. It pleases me very much, and you know it does. Rhoda took a handkerchief from her purse. However, it's going to be a little hard on my contentment for a day or two. Oh, damn.
Why, I should think it would add to your contentment.
Oh, shut up, Palmer. Thanks for the drink. You'd better go to your plane.
Look, don't be upset.
She smiled at him, her eyes tearful.
Why, everything's fine, dear. You might write, just once in a while. Just a friendly little scribble, so I'll know you're alive and well. I'd like that.
Of course I will. I'll write the day I get home.
Will you? Really? That's fine.
She touched her eyes with her handkerchief and stood.
Goodbye.
He said, getting to his feet.
They haven't called my plane.
No? Well, my chauffeuring job is finished, and I'm leaving you here and now.
They walked out of the lounge and shook hands in the quiet terminal.
War had all but shut down the airport. Most of the counters were dark.
Rhoda squeezed Dr. Kirby's hand, and standing on tiptoe, kissed him once on the lips. This, in a way, was strangest of all, reaching up to kiss a man. She opened her mouth. After all, it was a farewell.
Goodbye. Have a wonderful trip.
She hurried away and turned a corner without looking back. She saw enough of the Emil Jannings movie to be able to talk about it to Pug. Byron at last wrote the report on his adventures in Poland. Victor Henry, suppressing his annoyance over the 5 vapid pages, spent an afternoon dictating to his yeoman everything he remembered of Byron's tale. His son read the 17-page result next day with astonishment.
Ye gods, Dad, what a memory you have.
Take that and fix it any way you want. Just make sure it's factually unchallengeable. Combine it with your thing and let me have it back by Friday.
Victor Henry forwarded the patched report to the Office of Naval Intelligence, but forgot his idea of sending a copy to the president. The cool autumn days went by, and Berlin began taking on an almost peacetime look and mood.
Byron lounged around the Grunewald house, nodding his forehead by the hour over one book after another from Leslie Sloat's list. 3 or 4 times a week, he played tennis with his father. He was much the better player, but Pug, a steely plodder at first, wore him down and beat him. With food, exercise, and sun, however, Byron lost his famished look, regained strength, and started winning, which pleased Pug as much as it did him. One morning, he walked into his father's office at the embassy and saw, sitting on the floor, carefully roped up and ticketed with a tag in his own handwriting, the large valise of suits, shoes, and shirts he had left behind in Warsaw. It was a shocking little clue to the efficiency of the Germans, but he was glad to have the clothes, for American styles were idolized in Germany. He blossomed out as a dandy. The German girls in the embassy looked after the slender young man whenever he walked down the hall, casually a la mode, with heavy red-glinting brown hair, a lean face, and large blue eyes that widened when he wistfully smiled. But he ignored their inviting glances. Byron pounced on the mail every morning, searching in vain for a letter from Siena. When the Führer made his Reichstag speech offering peace to England and France early in October, the propaganda ministry set aside a large block of seats in the Kroll Opera House for foreign diplomats, and Pug took his son along. Living through the siege of Warsaw and then reading Mein Kampf, Byron had come to think of Adolf Hitler as a historic monster, a Caligula, a Genghis Khan, and Ivan the Terrible. And Hitler, standing at the podium, surprised him. Just a medium-sized, pudgy individual in a plain gray coat and black trousers, carrying a red portfolio. The man seemed to Byron a diminutive actor, weakly impersonating the grandiose and gruesome history-maker. Hitler spoke this time in a reasonable, pedestrian tone, like an elderly politician. In this sober style, the German leader began to utter such grotesque and laughable lies that Byron kept looking around for some amused reactions. But the Germans sat listening with serious faces. Even the diplomats gave way only here and there to a mouth twitch that might have been ironic. A powerful Poland had attacked Germany, the little man in the gray coat said, and had attempted to destroy her. The brave Wehrmacht had not been caught unawares and had justly punished this insolent aggression. A campaign strictly limited to attack of military targets had brought quick total victory. The civilian population of Poland, on his personal orders, had not been molested, and had suffered no loss or injury, except in Warsaw. There again, on his orders, the German commanders had pleaded with the authorities to evacuate their civilians, offering them safe conduct. The Poles, with criminal folly, had insisted on holding defenseless women and children within the city. To Byron, the brazenness of this assertion was stupefying. All the neutral diplomats had made desperate efforts for weeks to negotiate the evacuation of Warsaw's women and children. The Germans had never even replied. It was not so much that Hitler was lying about this. Byron knew that the German nation was following a wild liar, and had been for years, since Mein Kampf was full of obvious crazy lies, but that this lie was pointless, since the neutrals knew the facts, and the world press had reported them. Why, then, was Hitler saying such vulnerable nonsense? The speech must be meant for the Germans, but in that case, he reflected, as Hitler went on to offer an outstretched hand to the British and the French, why was the speech so mild in style? And why were so many seats reserved for diplomats? Surely, if 46 million Englishmen can claim to rule over 40 million square kilometers of the earth, then it cannot be wrong,
Hitler said in a docile, placating tone, holding up both hands, palms outward,
for 82 million Germans to ask to be allowed to till in peace 800,000 kilometers of soil that are historically their own.
He was talking about his new order in Central Europe and the expanded Third Reich. The British and the French could have peace simply by accepting things as they now were, he said, adding a hint that it might be well if they also gave Germany back her old colonies. The Führer at the end fell into his old style, howling and sneering, shaking both fists in front of his face, pointing a fist and a finger straight upward, snapping his hands to his hips, as he pictured the horrors of a full-scale war, which he said he dreaded, and which nobody could really win. That night, Pug Henry wrote in his intelligence report, "Hitler looks very well. He obviously has first-rate powers of recuperation. Maybe licking Poland toned up his system a bit. Anyway, the haggardness is gone, his color is excellent, and he isn't stooping. His voice is clear, not harsh, and, at least in this speech, very pleasant, and his walk is springy and quick. It would be a grave mistake to hope for a physical breakdown in this man." The speech was a lot of the same old stuff, with some remarkable whoppers, even for the Führer, about who started the Polish War and about the sterling conduct of the Germans toward civilians. This tommy rot was certainly for internal consumption. His German listeners appeared to be swallowing it, though it's very hard to discern what Germans really think. The radio tonight is making a great to-do about the outstretched hand peace proposal. We'll evidently be hearing outstretched hand from now on, possibly to the end of the war, even if it's 10 years hence. The offer may have been authentic. If the Allies accept, Germany gets her half of Poland for the price of a quick, cheap campaign, and also her pre-World War colonies, no doubt as a reward for the faultless chivalry of her armed forces. Hitler has never been bashful about making the most outrageous proposals. They've been accepted, too, so why not try another one? At the very least, if he gets the truce and the conference he suggests, the British and French publics will undoubtedly relax and slack off. The Germans can use the breather to get their half-hearted industrial effort rolling for the showdown. On every count, this was a clever speech by a leader who is riding high and seems to have the magic touch. The only fault I can find is a dull and boring delivery, but that too may have been calculated. Hitler today was the judicious European politician, not the roaring Aryan firebrand. Among his other talents, he is a gifted vaudevillian. Pug told Byron to write down his impressions of the speech. Byron handed him half a typewritten page. "My outstanding impression was the way Adolf Hitler follows out what he wrote in Mein Kampf. He says there, in his section on war propaganda, that the masses are feminine, acting on feeling and sentiment, and that whatever you tell them must be addressed to the dullest ignoramus among them, in order to reach and convince the broadest possible audience. This speech was full of lies that ought to annoy a half-educated German boy of 10, and the peace proposals amounted to a total German grab. Maybe Hitler judges other countries by his own. Otherwise, I can't understand the speech. I realized only today what utter contempt Hitler has for the Germans. He regards them as bottomlessly naive and stupid. They follow him and love him. Who am I to say he's wrong?" His father thought this was not bad, and included it in quotation marks as the comment of a youthful American spectator. The din of the German radio and press in the next days was terrific.
Italy and Japan had hailed the Führer as the greatest peacemaker of all time. A mighty popular surge for peace was sweeping the West and the United States. But Churchillian warmongers were trying to stamp out this warm response of the peoples to the Führer's outstretched hand. If they succeeded, the most ghastly bloodbath of all time would follow, and history would know whom to blame. Pug gathered from neutral intelligence in Berlin that some Frenchmen wanted to make a deal and call off the war, but not because they took seriously anything Hitler had said. It was just a question of yielding to the facts or fighting on. Into this confusing noise came an electric shock of news. A U-boat had sneaked into the British fleet anchorage in Scapa Flow at the northern tip of Scotland, had sunk the battleship Royal Oak, and had returned home safe. News pictures showed the solemn, fat-faced Führer shaking the hand of Lieutenant Commander Preen, a nervous, stiff young man with receding hair. The Nazi propaganda ministry foamed with ecstasy over the British Admiralty's report that sadly praised Preen's skill and daring. The writer was Churchill himself. Goebbels' broadcasters said the sinking of the Royal Oak would prove a great boon to peace, since the Führer's outstretched hand proposal would now receive more serious consideration. A small reception was laid on for neutral military attachés to meet Preen. Victor Henry put his son's name on the list with the rank Ensign, USNR, and Byron received a card. The Henrys dined before the reception at the apartment